Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. This week is going to sound a bit different, and that's a good thing. On June 16th, the Modern Love team produced an episode in front of a live audience at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space at WNYC in New York City. The team was part of a women's podcast festival called Work It. And here's how we worked it. One microphone at the front of the stage and John Parati, our sound designer, off to the side. Three actors performed essays, and while they read, John added sound effects and music live. So that's what you're going to hear. In addition, Iris Adler, executive producer of the podcast, sat down for a conversation with Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Producer Amory Sievertson hosted this event, and you will hear her voice throughout. So let's get started. The first reader is Lauren Molina, and she may sound familiar since she recorded our very first episode. Lauren reads Rosemary Counter's essay, A Craigslist Missed Connection Lure.
A decade ago, before Twitter and Instagram and when Facebook was still in its infancy, my university friends and I spent many hours lurking in Craigslist's Missed Connection section, sipping cheap rosé while perusing posts and laughing at the desperate souls who loitered there. The more pathetic the ads, the better. You, Asian in green toque. Me, skinny jeans reading. Wanted to say I liked your smile, but you got off at Eglinton. Perhaps it was a fluke, or maybe our habit made what happened inevitable. But one night, my friend Kate saw an ad that read, "You were at the Drake Hotel. Slim, with red hair in a black satin top. I didn't say hi because you were dancing with your friends. I've never done this before, but I thought, hey, it's worth a shot." "This is you!" she squealed. "This is seriously actually you." In those days, I was red-haired, and that night my friends and I, me in a black top, had indeed been sipping mojitos at the Drake, celebrating a birthday in an intimate group that, yes, might have been intimidating to a guy wanting to approach one of us. Despite how I had mocked those who posted on Missed Connections, I needed no convincing to reply. "So this is random," I wrote, "but I think I might be the girl you saw." He answered within the hour, shocked his post had found me, if I was in fact the woman he saw. After some witty banter, I sent him a photo. "It's you," he wrote. "I can't believe it's really you." At my request, he sent me a photo of himself, crooked smile and droopy-eyed with cropped hair. "I'm not very photogenic," he said, with charming self-deprecation. It all felt so sweet, strange, and surreal, and impossibly romantic. On our first date, he drove all the way downtown to pick me up for an early dinner. It was his pleasure, he explained, as he was dropping his brother off at the airport anyway. "Family is the most important thing to me," he said over a bottle of red wine in a candlelit cafe. "I know I'm not supposed to say this already, but I'm so ready to settle down. I just need the right girl." We bundled up and walked to the movie theater for a late screening, stopping at a cash machine along the way. "This is my treat," he said, something he would announce proudly and often in the days to come. When a young man passing by eyed us up and down, he wrapped his arm around my waist and said, "He's wondering what a girl like you is doing with someone like me." On the way home, he stopped at a vendor and bought me blue carnations. I had been burned so many times, I knew better than to get my hopes up about this leading anywhere. I almost prided myself on being jaded, on being immune to disappointment. But the next morning, he called to ask me out to breakfast. "I took the whole day off work," he said, because I can. We went for breakfast, and then because I didn't have the luxury of skipping my waitress shift, he drove me to work. "Do you need a drive home later?" he asked. Nobody had ever picked me up or cared how I'd get home, so I happily accepted. Over the next week, whenever I needed to go anywhere, he wanted to keep me company. He always had something special in mind, a restaurant reservation or tickets already purchased. One night, I mentioned I'd be missing America's Next Top Model, and the next day, he delivered me the whole boxed set. It was how I imagined how love was supposed to be. We were spending every free moment together. While other connections had felt forced, this was the twist of fate I had been waiting for. Although I was blissfully happy being spoiled and adored, my new life with my missed connection made me wonder how brutally fickle chance could be. What if Kate hadn't clicked on his ad that night? What if he had been too shy to post it? What if fate hadn't intervened and we had never met at all? And what if the universe, as quickly as it had given him to me, snatched him back? I posed questions like these to Kate and nearly everyone I knew, making me insufferable, I'm sure. And then 10 days into the best relationship I'd ever had, nonstop romance, presents, cuddling, Kate appeared unannounced at my doorstep. She hadn't seen me much recently, as bad friends like me often disappear when consumed with a new man, and she had a bad feeling. I had a bad feeling too, but mostly about her, imagining that she felt jealous, possessive, and alone. Chance had favored me, but not her, though I smugly assured her that someday that would change, if only she believed. Something had shifted in me when my silly fantasies turned real, and if there were any red flags, I refused to see them. So Kate pointed them out. Why, for example, didn't I know more about his life, despite having spent a solid week together? Because he was such a good listener that I did most of the talking. Why had I never been to his house? Because he lives way uptown and I don't drive. Why the disproportionate number of presents? Because he's the most generous man I've ever met. Why were we going on 3 dates a day? Because I was finally getting the attention I deserved. In any case, I cut a deal with Kate and agreed to call and press him ever so gently. On my flip phone from a parking lot, I said, "My friend is probably totally crazy, but is there anything you should tell me?" Normally the strong, silent type, he burst into tears. It was almost as if he had been waiting to confess. This moment, a release he had been anticipating. He was married, of course, and under a lot of pressure. He had one child already and another on the way. He didn't have a brother. It was his wife he dropped off at the airport. She and their child had gone to visit family and would be back in a few days. And the clincher? Though he had heard good things about it, he had never been to the Drake Hotel. He did, however, truly like redheads. "I chose you," he said. "You were special." But he hadn't chosen me. He laid a trap for women with red hair and black tops, and I was the one who walked into it. Chance hadn't favored me. It had targeted me, tapping something in me that was dormant but susceptible to romantic delusion. After all, long before he placed his ad, I had been loitering on Craigslist, mocking people who I thought were lonely and needy and nothing like me. But they were everything like me. We were all hoping love wouldn't miss us. We were all eager to believe that love for us was meant to be. After our 10 intense days together, my missed connection disappeared as quickly as he had arrived, timed almost to the day of his wife's return. I imagined him picking her up at the airport with a bouquet of blue carnations, or some special present with a secret meaning only they would understand. Or maybe he didn't do things like that for her anymore. For a long time, I considered sending her an email, possibly anonymously, but decided against it. I didn't know her or what she might do. Those rambunctious evenings of rosé and Craigslist stalking are long gone. But sometimes I type the name of my missed connection into Google, and there he is, easily found now on nearly every social media platform, smiling wide with his arms crossed or tweeting about his life's minute details. Everything I needed to know is right there, a decade too late. Meanwhile, he and his wife have divorced. They weren't meant to be either, apparently. One thing I do know, meant to be is just a fairy tale we tell ourselves. Sometimes, it's even an ad on Craigslist.
Lauren Molina. Thank you so much, Lauren. So you can see Lauren next month performing off-Broadway. The show is called Sex Tips for a Straight Woman from a Gay Man. Thank you so much, Lauren. Beautifully done. If you've been subscribed to the podcast from the very beginning, you might know that Lauren was our very first episode of the podcast, and we were very thrilled to have her here to do this live for you here tonight. But one of the great things about Modern Love, the column itself, is that it brings us all of these stories of different kinds of love, right? So you've got the romantic love, you've got friendship, and then you have family love. So this next piece pertains to that. This is a story about a new mother who starts confronting just some of those unpredictable, really difficult challenges of parenthood before she's even brought her daughter home. So here to read this one is Amira Van. She stars as Miss Ernestine in the WGN America series Underground, which just got picked up for a second season, so that's very exciting. She's also appeared in HBO's Girls and the Amazon series Mozart in the Jungle. So please welcome Amira Van reading Elizabeth Fitzsimons' essay, My First Lesson in Motherhood.
I saw the scar the first time I changed Natalie's diaper, just an hour after the orphanage director handed her to me in a hotel banquet room in Nanchang, a provincial capital in southeastern China. Despite the high heat and humidity, her caretakers had dressed her in two layers, and as I peeled back her sweaty clothes, I found the worst diaper rash I'd ever seen, and a 2-inch scar at the base of her spine, cutting through the red bumps and peeling skin. The next day, when the Chinese government would complete the adoption, was also Natalie's first birthday. We had a party for her that night, attended by families we'd met and representatives of the adoption agency, and Natalie licked cake frosting from my finger. But we worried about a rattle in her chest, and there was the scar. So afterward, my husband Matt asked our adoption agency to send the doctor. We had other concerns too. Natalie was thin and pale and couldn't sit up or hold a bottle. She had only two teeth, barely any hair, and wouldn't smile. But I had anticipated such things. My sister and two brothers were adopted from Nicaragua, the boys as infants, and when they came home, there were smelly, scabies-covered babies who could barely hold their heads up. Yet those problems soon disappeared. I believe Natalie would be fine too. There was clearly a light on behind those big, dark eyes. She rested her head against my chest in a baby carrier and would stare up at my face, her lips parting as she leaned back, as if she knew she was now safe. She would be our first child. We had set our hearts on adopting a baby girl from China years before, when I was reporting a newspaper story about a local mayor's return home with her new Chinese daughter. Adopting would come later, we thought, after I became pregnant. But I didn't become pregnant. And after 2 years of trying, I was tired of feeling hopeless, of trudging down this path not knowing how it would end. I did know, however, how adopting would end. With a baby. So we'd go to China first, and then try to have a biological child. We embarked on a process lasting months of preparing our application and opening our life to scrutiny until one day we had a picture of our daughter on our refrigerator. 14 months after deciding to adopt, we were in China. And now we were in a hospital room with a Chinese doctor, an older man who spoke broken English. After listening to Natalie's chest, he said she had bronchitis. Then he turned her over and looked at her scar. He suspected she had a tumor removed and wondered aloud if she had spina bifida before finally saying that she would need to be seen at a hospital. Two taxis took us all there, and as we waited to hear news, I tried to think positive thoughts of the room we had painted for Natalie in light yellow and the crib with Winnie the Pooh sheets. But my mind shifted when I saw one of the women from the agency in a heated exchange in Chinese with the doctors, then with someone on her cell phone. We pleaded with her for information. A CT scan confirmed there had been a tumor that someone, somewhere, had removed. It had been a sloppy job. Nerves were damaged, and as Natalie grew, her condition would worsen, eventually leaving her paralyzed from the waist down. Yes, she had a form of spina bifida, as well as a cyst on her spine. I looked at my husband in shock, waiting for him to tell me that I had misunderstood everything. But he only shook his head. I held on to him and cried into his chest, angry that creating a family seemed so impossible for us, and that life had already been so difficult for Natalie. Back at the hotel, we hounded the woman from the agency. Why wasn't this in her medical report? How could a scar that size not be noticed? It was 2 inches long, for God's sake. They shook their heads, shrugged, apologized, and then they offered a way to make it better. In cases like these, we can make a rematch with another baby, the one in charge said. The rest of the process would be expedited and we would go home on schedule. We would simply leave with a different girl. Months before, we had been presented with forms asking which disabilities would be acceptable in a prospective adoptee. What, in other words, did we think we could handle? HIV, hepatitis, blindness. We checked off a few mild problems that we knew could be swiftly corrected with proper medical care. As Matt had written on our application, this will be our first child, and we feel we would need more experience to handle anything more serious. Now we faced surgeries, wheelchairs, colostomy bags. I envisioned our home in San Diego with ramps leading to the doors. I saw our lives as being utterly devoted to her care. How would we ever manage? Yet how could we leave her? Had I given birth to a child with these conditions, I wouldn't have left her in the hospital. Though a friend would later say, well, that's different. It wasn't to me. I pictured myself boarding the plane with some faceless replacement child and then explaining to friends and family that she wasn't Natalie, that we had left Natalie in China because she was too damaged, that the deal had been a healthy baby and she wasn't. How would I face myself? How would I ever forget? I would always wonder what happened to Natalie. I knew this was my test, my life's worth distilled into a moment. I was shaking my head no before they finished explaining. We didn't want another baby. I told them we wanted our baby, the one sleeping right over there. She's our daughter, I said. We love her. We had a long, fraught night ahead, wondering how we would possibly cope. I called my mother in tears and told her the news. There was a long pause. Oh, honey. I sobbed. She waited until I caught my breath. it would be okay if you came home without her. Why are you saying that? I just wanted to absolve you. What do you want to do? I want to take my baby and get out of here, I said. Good, my mother said. Then that's what you should do. In the morning, bleary-eyed and aching, we decided we would be happy with our decision. And we did feel happy. We told ourselves that excellent medical care might mitigate some of her worst afflictions. It was the best we could hope for. But within 2 days of returning to San Diego, before we had even been able to take her to the pediatrician, things took yet another alarming turn. While eating dinner in her high chair, Natalie had a seizure, where her head fell forward, then snapped back. Her eyes rolled and her legs and arms shot out ramrod straight. I pulled her from the high chair, handed her to Matt, and called 911. When the paramedics arrived, Natalie was alert and stable, but then she suffered a second seizure in the emergency room. We told the doctors what we had learned in China, and they ordered a CT scan of her brain. Hours later, one of the emergency room doctors pulled up a chair and said gravely, "You must know something is wrong with her brain, right?" We stared at her. Something was wrong with her brain, too, in addition to everything else? Well, she told us, Natalie's brain is atrophic. I fished into my purse for a pen as she compared Natalie's condition to Down syndrome, saying that a loving home can make all the difference. It was clear, she added, that we had that kind of home. She left us, and I cradled Natalie, who was knocked out from seizure medicine. Her mouth was open, and I leaned down, breathing in her sweet breath that smelt like soy formula. Would we ever be able to speak to each other? Would she tell me her secrets, laugh with me? Whatever the case, I would love her, and she would know it. And that would have to be enough. I thank God we hadn't left her. She was admitted to the hospital, where we spent a fitful night at her bedside. In the morning, the chief of neurosurgery came in. When we asked him for news, he said, "It's easier if I show you." In the radiology department screening room, pointing at the CT scan, he told us the emergency room doctor had erred. Natalie's brain wasn't atrophic. She was weak and had fallen behind developmentally, but she had hand-eye coordination and had watched him intently as he examined her. He'd need an MRI for a better diagnosis. We asked him to take images of Natalie's spine, too. He returned with more remarkable news. The MRI ruled out the brain syndromes he was worried about, and nothing was wrong with Natalie's spine. She did not have spina bifida. She would not become paralyzed. He couldn't believe anyone could make such a diagnosis from the poor quality of the Chinese CT film. He conceded there probably had been a tumor and that would need to be monitored, but she might be fine. The next year would tell. There would be other scares, more seizures and more physical therapy to teach her to sit, crawl, and walk. She took her first steps one day on the beach at 21 months, her belly full of fish tacos. Now she is nearly 3, with thick brown hair, gleaming teeth, and twinkling eyes. She takes swimming lessons, goes to daycare, and insists on wearing flowered sandals to dance. I say to her, "Oh, Natalie." And she answers, "Oh, Mama." And I blink back happy tears. Sometimes when I'm rocking her to sleep, I lean down and breathe in her breath, which now smells of bubblegum toothpaste and the dinner I cook for her while she sat in her high chair singing to the dog. And I am amazed that this little girl is mine. It's tempting to think that our decision was validated by the fact that everything turned out okay. But for me, that's not the point. Our decision was right because she was our daughter and we loved her. We would not have chosen the burdens we anticipated. But we are stronger than we thought.
Amira Van, thank you. Amira Van, reading Elizabeth Fitzsimons' essay, My First Lesson in Motherhood. Aren't these fun? Isn't this just fun to listen to these out loud? And of course, John here is making all the magic happen. If you do subscribe to the podcast and you've ever loved what you've heard, music choices, you know, the timing of music, if you're a podcaster yourself and you appreciate those kinds of things, like we do sometimes when we're nerding out and we go, oh, isn't that just so satisfying how the music came up right there and then it went back down? But Amir, if you want to keep up with her and with that second season of Underground, which is forthcoming, she's on Twitter at Amira Van. Van has two N's in it. But now, it's my great pleasure to introduce two people without whom this podcast really just would not be possible. We have Daniel Jones, the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, and Iris Adler, the executive producer of the podcast. Please help me welcome them to the stage.
I, for one, need to collect myself after that reading. What?
And me too.
A space she puts us in. I've heard it 25 times, and every time I just go there with her. So, Dan is not only the editor of the column at the New York Times, he's also the creator and founder of the column and has been doing it for 12 years now. And so, at some point along the way, you get a phone call from a public radio station in Boston says, hey, we love your column, and we love to do the audio version. Tell us what your reaction was.
Well, Charlie Kravitz at WBOR just sort of called me out of the blue. I'm still not sure how you got my number, to tell you the truth. It was on my cell phone.
And he's never going to tell.
And he was driving, so he had to pause a few times to make turns in the call. But he said, we're fans of this column, and we see a future in audio for these stories. And this was not, this was 3 years before the podcast actually launched. And there's been a lot of interest in Modern Love over the years. There was a TV pilot made. There's this constant sort of, you know, what can we do with this material that's more than it already is? And none of it ever pans out. So by the time Charlie called, I was flattered but pessimistic. And my pessimism was borne out as the years passed and nothing ever developed. And then just out of the blue, whatever logjam had been in place was broken, and we were all systems go with this. This was just the middle of last summer. You know, to WBUR's credit, it was, I never feel like I can move forward in something until you figured it all out. And with this team, they were like, we'll make something good. You know, we'll figure it out as we go along. And the meetings were very open. You know, what should we do? What should this be? And it was a lot of fun. And the idea that we would have, you know, actors read these, and that how would we bring the writers in, and how would we talk about them? That was just all open to discussion, and it happened. I was, you know, I was sort of amazed.
So let's flash forward to February 2016. Finally, it happens, and we have our first two podcasts. One's a beautiful story of a fish dying, allegorical. Obviously, mm-hmm. And the other story that you heard tonight, Lauren Molina's beautiful read. When you first hear them, and these are your stories, your babies that you nurtured and crafted, and you hear them in audio form, what was it like for you?
Yeah, well, with these first two that we'd worked, you know, people had worked so hard on to really figure out what could be done. And I mean, I was blown away. These are stories that I'm so familiar with, you know, the editorial process and the publication process and post-publication and all of that. I get immersed in these stories and help to shape them. And so any element of surprise or drama, all of that is stripped away. It's very hard to read them with satisfaction time and time again. You're just too exposed to what the story already is. So to have these you know, brought to life in a fresh way, with sort of interpreted by these talented actors, to have this soundscaping and music, you know, little subtle sounds. And so I'm pretty, you know, I'm a sensitive guy, I guess, but I'm also pretty desensitized to a lot of the drama in these stories. I feel like I'm sort of reading them as an editor, and sometimes that I cheat myself out of the emotional content of the story in a way. And this process, I just felt like brought it all back in spades. Like to hear Jason Alexander reading this story about you know, this goldfish, but then it became a story that was a lot more than a goldfish, and was really about mortality and Dan Barry's parents and his own battle with cancer. Oh my God, it wrecked me. It really wrecked me. And this was again a story that had held no surprises for me. it was a real treat.
It's a little like when we read the column every week. We're blown away, not having that desensitization process. But for the listener or the reader, what do you think the difference is, the experience between reading the column in the Times or experiencing it as a podcast?
I mean, I appreciate both for different reasons. I thought the columns written, the audience for the written column would become the podcast audience. And I'm sure that's true to, you know, a large extent. But I have a lot of good friends who never read the column and didn't really admit that to me until the podcast came out. And they said, you know,
friends,
I just,
right?
You know, I don't, you know, I just don't, I don't read it every week. I don't really read it at all. But I love this podcast. And So, to tell you the truth, there are a lot of people who, when we first announced the podcast, people always have something to complain about. You learn that if you work at the Times for very long. And so, you know, we're a receptacle of constant complaints. And I thought, like, who could ever complain about this project? Nobody could ever complain about this project. So when we first launched it, we had this page, and people could write comments next to it. And people were actually like writing comments like, another good thing ruined.
And I preferred reading it. Why do I have to listen to it?
I prefer reading. Can't we just read things? And I was like, this is in addition to the column. Like, read the column if you want to read the column. But this is another, you know, this is a value added, you know. But no, it was just the reaction of, no, I want to read the column. But I think there are a lot of converts. I think a lot of people, the idea of hearing someone read a printed thing, they thought, well, that's boring, you know, that's potentially boring. And there have been a lot of converts of people who say, oh, now I get it, you know, when they really hear it.
And in fact, some of those comments also challenged us, why aren't you having the writers read their own columns? We felt very strongly that, as you've seen tonight, this is an art to be able to narrate stories. And so that was part of what we felt we really needed to commit to get the absolute best readers we could. But I wonder what your sense is of that, Dan, having these actors read as opposed to the writers. Do you think it loses any authenticity, or is there something lost in the process?
No, I thought those were valid points that people were making in advance. They're saying that, like, some people said, well, the charm of the column is it's all these people who, you know, 99% of them you've never heard of, and that the charm is the sort of rough edges and the actual voices and all of that. But I, you know, so I have been in this writing business for 30 years now. I've been to writing conferences and Breadloaf and all these places, and I've sat through reading after reading after reading after reading by professional writers, and I'd say about 5% of them are really good, and 10% of them are tolerable, and maybe 60%, you know, put people to sleep. And these are some of the most famous writers, you know, who have the most experience in reading before an audience. I think it's a skill. It's a skill, and to be able to interpret what someone else has written and bring your own emotion to it and be, you know, have the experience and the talent to bring that to it is evident in how these really pack a punch. Also, we wanted the whole archive to be at our disposal. And if we're going to have the writers read them who are scattered around this country, and some of whom would not want to participate in that way and would not want to read, we wanted the whole archive to be available and to be able to get these people into studios and have them done that way. So that was part of it, but that was a minor part. It was really just wanting these powerful readings.
And for those of you who may have not heard the podcast, after the reading of the column itself, we do bring the writer on. We track them down, we find them, and we do a kind of, well, what's happened since? Because most of these columns are from several years ago, and it's very interesting then to hear the voice of the writer and to hear what's transpired in their lives since the column. So that's a big part of it. So your day job, though, Dan, is still to... You get how many requests a week? How many entries do you get people hoping to
get
published?
Column gets about 8,000 submissions a year, and we publish 52, and that breaks down to one every 200 or
so
something.
So what are you looking for? I mean, with that kind of volume, what is it that you're looking for? You can't read them, certainly, from beginning to end. You do a quick eyeballing and look for what?
Here's the secret. So every column that piques my interest has it displays sort of vulnerability and intelligence in almost equal measure, and that's a very hard balance to achieve, because vulnerability is not being aware, is being weak in a certain way, is not knowing what you're doing, and being willing to admit it. But you have to reflect on that experience with a certain intelligence where, you know, this is a smart readership, and they've heard all these stories in one form or another. So you have to make something of that experience and explain it in a way and come to some sort of understanding by the end that a smart reader will read and think, that's said in a way that I didn't quite think of, or that I've been struggling with that and I hadn't quite seen it in that way. So when a story really hits and does well, it has that combination, particular for this column and in this section, it has to have some, it helps if it has some contemporary angle, and if the relationship or what it's exploring really has to do with now, today, and that either means it takes place now or today, or it has to do with technology or changes in medicine or changes in how we form families and, you know, what is happening now. Any old great story, I'll find a way to get in. And maybe mask by not revealing everything that it actually happened 20 years ago. But it really helps if it's recent. It's got all those elements.
So that means you're sending out a lot of rejection emails. And I have to say, there's a bit of a setup. Dan has shared with us some of the emails he's received from said recipients of rejection emails. And I can't let you go today without asking you to share some of those with us.
Yeah, So this acceptance and rejection process is all done by mail. It by email, it's, I'm saying no, 190 times and saying yes once. So my job is really saying no all week long. It's reading stuff and saying no nonstop. And I send a personalized letter to everybody, put their name on it. I've been on the other end of this enough where I know what it feels like to be rejected. So I've tried to be kind about it and responsible about it. Nevertheless, some people get very angry. Men more than women.
Shocker.
men are more surprised when they're rejected than women. And they think that a mistake has been made somehow. that their piece possibly didn't earn a spot. That something had to have gone wrong. So some people who get angry send me emails back, very ill-advised. But I treasure them. And I have a whole folder of these. I've saved some of the best ones for you. So I just have a few of these where people have said mean things. It didn't hurt, though. I'm used to it. Dear editor of Modern Love, you need help. Professional help. Journalists are having to work at Al Jazeera. Do you want that to happen to you? That was just a ridiculous response. I mean, it just is. So this person, the next person wrote, and this was from a guy. So was the first. And only 20% of the submissions are from men. That's the other thing. You didn't even read it, dude. Now, normally I don't respond to these, but in this case, I had read it. I'd read it actually from start to finish. And I couldn't not reply, so I replied, dude, I totally did. That's the bad news. I read the whole thing. And then this woman, she was kind of sweet. She wrote, dear Mr. Jones, is there really a Mr. Jones? The story I submitted is compelling and evokes a mountain of emotion. I'm beginning to wonder if I have to know somebody, or know somebody who knows somebody. I don't know anybody. Am I dead? With this letter, I probably am. So, one time I accepted someone's piece, and she rejected me. Fair enough. So this woman, I'd sat on her essay for about 3 months. I was way behind, as I always am. And it turned out that she was conducting a job search and had all these applicants for the job. And so I sent an email that said, very briefly, my apologies for taking so long to respond to your submission. I'm interested in it. Is it still available? And about 5 minutes later, she replied, I'm sorry, the position has been filled. Thank you for your interest. So then I had to write her back and say, I actually wasn't applying for the position. And she wrote back a mortified email. And we published her story.
All right. Thank you, Dan, so much for the wonderful work you do at The Times and for all of your help, assistance, and guidance on the podcast. We're so grateful.
Thank you, Iris. And thank you, WBUR, and thank you, audience.
That's Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. He was speaking with WBUR's Iris Adler, executive producer of the podcast. Don't move. We'll hear one more live essay after the break. We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it's time for our last performance from the live Modern Love event at WNYC's Green Space. Michaela Watkins, star of the Hulu series Casual, took on Amy Sutherland's essay, What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage. Here's Michaela Watkins.
As I wash dishes at the kitchen sink, my husband paces behind me, irritated. Have you seen my keys? He snarls, then huffs out a loud sigh, stomps from the room, and our dog, Dixie, at his heels, anxious over her favorite humans, upset. In the past, I would have been right behind Dixie. I would have turned off the faucet and joined the hunt while trying to soothe my husband with bromides like, don't worry, they'll turn up. But that only made him angrier, and a simple case of missing keys would soon become a full-blown, angst-ridden drama starring the two of us and our very poor, very nervous dog. Now, I focus on the wet dishes in my hand. I don't turn around. I don't say a word. I'm using a technique I learned from a dolphin trainer. I love my husband. He's well-read, he's adventurous, and does a hysterical rendition of a northern Vermont accent that still cracks me up after 12 years of marriage. But he also tends to be forgetful and is often tardy and mercurial. He leaves wadded tissues in his wake. He suffers from serious bouts of spousal deafness, but never fails to hear me when I mutter to myself on the other side of the house, "What did you say?" He'll shout. These minor annoyances are not the stuff of separation and divorce, but in sum, they begin to dull my love for Scott. I needed to nudge him a little closer to perfect, to make him into a mate who might not annoy me, or just annoy me a little less, a mate who would be easier to love. So, like many wives before me, I ignored a library of advice books and set up about improving him. By nagging, of course, which only made his behavior worse. He'd drive faster instead of slower, shave less frequently, not more, and leave his reeking exercise clothes on the bedroom floor longer than ever. We went to a counselor, smooth the edges off our marriage. She didn't understand why we were there and complimented us repeatedly on how well we communicated. I gave up. I guess she was right. Our union was better than most, and resigned myself to stretches of slow boil resentment and occasional sarcasm. Then, something magical happened. For a book I was writing about a school for exotic animal trainers, I started commuting from Maine to California, where I spent my days watching students do the seemingly impossible. Teaching hyenas to pirouette on command, cougars to offer their paw for a nail clipping, and baboons to skateboard. I listened, rapt, as professional trainers explained how they taught dolphins to flip and elephants to paint, and eventually it hit me that the same techniques might work on that stubborn but lovable species, the American husband. The central lesson I learned from exotic animal trainers is that I should reward behavior I like and ignore behavior I don't. After all, you don't get a sea lion to balance a ball on the end of its nose by nagging. The same goes for the American husband. Back in Maine, I began thanking Scott if he threw one dirty shirt into the hamper. If he threw two, I'd kiss him. Meanwhile, I would step over any soiled clothes on the floor without one sharp word. As he basked in my appreciation, the piles became smaller. I also began to analyze my husband the way trainers consider an exotic animal. Enlightened trainers learn all they can about a species, from anatomy to social structure, to understand how it thinks, what it likes, dislikes, what comes easily to it, and what doesn't. For example, an elephant is a herd animal, so it responds to hierarchy. It cannot jump, but can stand on its head. It is a vegetarian. The exotic animal known as Scott is a loner, but an alpha male. So hierarchy matters, but being in a group doesn't so much. He has the balance of a gymnast, but moves slowly, especially when getting dressed. Skiing comes more naturally, but being on time doesn't. He's an omnivore and what a trainer would call food-driven. Once I started thinking this way, I couldn't stop. At the school in California, I'd be scribbling notes on how to walk an emu or have a wolf accept you as a pack member, but I'd be thinking, I can't wait to try this on Scott. A dolphin trainer introduced me to least reinforcing syndrome, LRS, least reinforcing syndrome. When a dolphin does something wrong, the trainer does not respond in any way. He stands still for a few beats, careful not to look at the dolphin, and then returns to work. The idea is that any response, positive or negative, fuels behavior. If a behavior provokes no response, it typically dies away. In the margins of my notes, I wrote, "Try on Scott." It was only a matter of time before he was again tearing around the house, searching for his keys, at which point I said nothing, and I kept at what I was doing. It took a lot of discipline to maintain my calm, but results were immediate and stunning. His temper fell far shy of its usual pitch and then waned like a fast-moving storm. I felt as if I should just throw him a mackerel. Now he's at it again. I hear him banging a closet door shut, rustling through papers on a chest in the front hall, thumping upstairs. At the sink, I hold steady. Then, sure enough, all goes quiet. A moment later, he walks in the kitchen, keys in hand, and says calmly, "Found them." Without turning, I call out, "Great, see you later." Off he goes with our much calmed pup. After 2 years of exotic animal training, my marriage is far smoother, my husband much easier to love. I used to take his faults personally. His dirty clothes on the floor were an affront, a symbol of how he didn't care enough about me. But thinking of my husband as an exotic species gave me the distance I needed to consider our differences more objectively. I adopted the trainer's motto, "It's never the animal's fault." When my training attempts failed, I didn't blame Scott. Rather, I brainstormed new strategies. I dissected my own behavior, considered how my actions might inadvertently fuel his. I also accepted that some behaviors were too entrenched, too instinctive to train away. You can't stop a badger from digging, and you can't stop my husband from losing his wallet and his keys. Professionals talk of animals that understand training so well that they eventually use it back on the trainer. My animal did the same. When the training techniques worked so beautifully, I couldn't resist telling my husband what I was up to. He wasn't offended, he was just amused. As I explained the techniques and terminology, he just soaked it up. Far more than I realized. Last fall, firmly in middle age, I learned that I needed braces. They were not only humiliating, but also excruciating. For weeks, my gums, my teeth, jaw, sinuses throbbed. I complained frequently and loudly. Scott assured me that I would become used to all the metal in my mouth. I did not. One morning, as I launched into yet another tirade about how uncomfortable I was, Scott just looked at me blankly. He didn't say a word or acknowledge my rant in any way, not even with a nod. I quickly ran out of steam and then I walked away. Then I realized what was happening. And I turned and I asked, "Are you giving me an LRS? Silence. "You are, aren't you?" He finally smiled, but his LRS had already done the trick. He begun to train me, the American wife.
That was Michaela Watkins, star of the Hulu series Casual. She was reading Amy Sutherland's essay, "What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage." Thanks to Lauren Molina, Amira Van, and Michaela Watkins for reading at the event. Special thanks to Jennifer Sendro, Ellen Rolfes, and Denise Bennett at New York Public Radio for all of their help. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippens. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week. If you love Modern Love, check out WBUR's advice podcast, Dear Sugar, where hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond answer all your questions, no matter how deep or dark. Subscribe to Dear Sugar on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.